There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Phidias Club. This show is a show about people whom we listen to and get opinions and news from around the world. We get people from different backgrounds and different countries and different cultures, and we try to understand how things are perceived in those places. But every once in a while, we do a special where we talk about something else, a specific topic that we explore and also try to understand. This is one such episode. It is about autism and neurodiversity, as my guest likes to call it. I guess it's a term I learned very recently. My name is Patrick Beja, and my guest is Guillaume Haché, and not Haches. How's it going, Guillaume?
Yeah, this joke never gets old. Hi, Patrick. Thanks for having me for the third time already on this wonderful show.
I'm very glad to have you on, and on a topic that is dear to your heart, because I learned actually just, what is it, a couple of months ago, that you are on the spectrum. You're autistic.
About 6 weeks ago, I think we had this conversation. Already an interesting choice of word. You mentioned I am autistic. We'll drift on this later on, I think. But that's a very interesting choice of word.
Yeah, I think, you know, the spectrum is a word that I think most people understand nowadays. It seems like in the past few years, that has become more prevalent in trying to describe people who are, well, for lack of another term, autistic, but on the spectrum of autism, because there are various levels of autism. And you also taught me another word, which I didn't know, which I mentioned at the beginning, which is neurodiversity, which is really interesting because when you give something a name, you kind of make it exist. And the mere fact that neurodiversity is, it sounded weird at first, but I guess it's very descriptive. It's exactly what it says. And so can you tell us, just to start, what are the differences between autism, the spectrum of autism, and neurodiversity?
Okay, so I would say that autism is, and the autism spectrum is a subset of neurodiversity in the same way that you would say that autistic people are a subset of the human species. Within neurodiversity, you would have, first of all, neurotypicals. That's yet another new word for you, maybe.
So neurotypicals, meaning... If I want to be offensive, I will say normal people. You know that's where I was going to go, but so...
Sure, like the muggles in Harry Potter, So you would have, within this neurodiversity, you would have neurotypicals. You would have perhaps also people who are on the autism spectrum. And all sorts of other things, like maybe, being bipolar is also part of this neurodiversity we're talking about.
Do you have an idea, just that's a slight tangent, but do you have an idea of how many people, maybe a percentage, and I'm sure it varies depending on the country or whatever, many different factors, but how many people are neurotypical and how many people are neuroatypical, I guess? I'm guessing that the percentage might surprise people, but...
Right. I mean, okay, so it's a very simple question, but obviously the answer is very complex. So for a lot of questions you might have, there are two answers I could give you. The first one is the one you find in textbooks, and in this case, it would be something like, oh, there is maybe 1% of people who are on the autism spectrum. So that's the quote-unquote official classic answer to this question. But the truth is often much more complex, I think. In the case of autism, there's a lot to unpack here. I mean, we haven't really mentioned what autism really
sure,
is
let's,
at this
let's
point.
Start at so, the beginning. So we'll, yeah, we'll, I, yeah. I was, you know, trying to go out on tangents, but maybe it's better to take things in order.
Sure.
Go ahead. So tell us, what is autism?
I think an interesting way to go about it could be you who maybe aren't an expert on this topic. What would be the cliche, the stereotypical description of autism for someone who's not an expert?
You're putting me on the spot. I like it. Very nice. I think perception.
I have an interviewer syndrome, meaning even when I'm not on my own podcast, I like to ask questions. Yeah, go ahead.
I think there would be two typical images that come to people's minds when they think about autism. It would be either Rain Man, essentially the strange genius who can do things that kind of has superpowers, but doesn't really know how to interact with people, is kind of a shut-in. And then on the other end of that, spectrum, would be someone who is actually impaired psychologically and who has difficulties interacting with people at the most basic level, maybe difficulties to speak, the image of the kid that overloads their system and that curls up in a bowl and maybe screams and is in overload mode. That's the what I suspect would be the two extremes. Obviously, as I mentioned, with the autism spectrum being a more well-known thing, I actually do understand that it's very varied. And I even have seen TV shows where one of the characters was had Asperger's syndrome, which is essentially a mild manifestation of that state.
I'm really enjoying hearing you struggle with words. We'll explore the terms Asperger's syndrome in just a bit, which is also a very interesting topic of. It's also a very very interesting thing to explore. First of all, congratulations, because you did not use the word illness, or you did not say it was a mental illness or being impaired. You did mention an impairment.
I think then I'm going to revert to asking you questions. You don't think it's fair to call it an impairment, because it seems like it makes it more difficult to interact with people, right?
No, it's okay. So impairment can be fair, but a word you often hear is illness or something like that, which is absolutely wrong. Autism is not an illness. It's not being sick. The only word that you should use, it's a difference. You know, there are in life, there are tall people, there are short people, there are people who are overweight, people who are underweight, there are people who are neurotypicals, and there are people who are on the autism spectrum. Okay, so it's not an illness. It's not anything. Anything wrong with there isn't anything wrong with being autistic, in the same way that, you know, maybe a couple decades ago people would say that sexual orientation, and you know, being homosexual, for instance, was considered for some as an illness. Well, autism for some has for a long time been considered as an illness, but it is not.
Okay, so, let me challenge you on that for a second. Yeah. Let me challenge you on that for a second, because at least for some people who are on the autism spectrum, it does create difficulties in interacting, right? Socially, it can be more difficult to interact with others. There can be some perception problems. There can be some sensory issues where you perceive things more strongly. If it makes it more difficult for you to interact, isn't it fair to say maybe not an I see where you're going with the illness thing.
Yeah.
But
right.
I don't think it's completely unfair to say there is something that is functioning in a different... Okay, you get where I'm going. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I do. So it's interesting because we still haven't explored what autism is, but we're already delving into the notions of impairments and disabilities and stuff like that. So
all right, so
we're going at this in a So okay, so I think what you're getting at is that an illness is within someone. It's an attribute. It's a property of you within yourself. Whereas a disability, or in French we say a handicap, which is a word that's not very used in English, I think. But a disability is a social construct. And that's very important to understand. So for instance, Patrick, you cannot breathe underwater and you cannot fly, I don't think. Or, I mean, I don't think you
can. I haven't tried in a while, but yes, I think it's fair to say I can't fly.
Right. And no one is looking at you saying, well, look at this dude. Look at this guy. He can fly. He's ill. You know, no one is doing that because you meet the standards, okay? Mm-hmm. And so when you say, look at this autistic person who has trouble interacting with others and who is perhaps, you know, has special needs and so on, you are putting the bar at the level of neurotypicals. You know, you're using the social norm to judge this person. You say, oh, okay, this person does not meet the social norm. This person is not a quote-unquote normal, typical person. Therefore, this person has a problem. That's essentially what you were saying just a minute ago.
Yeah, no, completely. I completely understand why you would have a problem with this. But at the same time, I think it is... very logical to not judge. Again, I'm trying to choose my words carefully, but to evaluate people's abilities and states according to the typical person. Because, you know, you were talking about disabilities, for example. If you are constructing, I don't know, a bus, or let's say a car. You're going to design a car for people who have two arms and two legs. Now, if one person has only one arm or no arms, then they are atypical, but there are going to be some impairments to the way they can function in society, in a society which is designed for typical people. And you're completely right that there are many, many different types of atypicality, but it seems pushing it a little bit to say, well, it's only differences. There aren't any impacts into the life in society, in a society that is designed for typical people. Let me finish.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that we shouldn't make sure that everyone is included, and quite the opposite. Obviously, I think we should make sure that everyone has access to everything, but it seems... it seems inaccurate to me to say someone who isn't typical is typical, or is just a difference and it doesn't impact the way they interact or the way they live. So
I did not say that. I said it's not an illness. It's not anything wrong within the individual. The difficulty and the struggle that one might experience is the product of this social norm, this social construct. A disability is a social okay. construct. Yeah.
So what you're saying is, well, okay, we could argue, I think we're delving into semantics here, but okay, we could argue about this for a long time, but I see where you're getting at. I do wonder, however, what you do consider an illness, or, you know, like if someone has a weak heart, that means they can't run for too long, for example. Oh. Is that they're just constructed differently, they can function properly, they just can't run as long as someone else. Is that not considered an illness or a physical condition? Or a condition, period?
I mean, okay, so
maybe I'm going too far into that very specific debate and conversation, but
yeah, because you're using a very abstract, like a heart condition. I mean, it's a very abstract.
I don't think it's that abstract thing. Because yeah. what I'm trying to say is, if this very physical thing means that you can't interact with others or, you know, with the world in the same way that typical people can, this is still considered an illness. And I wonder if in neurodiversity, someone who's on the spectrum.
I would say if the person with a heart condition is at risk, if they are, you know, if they stay in their room for their whole life and they are still being in danger, they are still on the risk of having a problem, then yeah, it's an illness. But if the only reason that they will suffer is by comparison to quote unquote typical people, then it's more of a disability and more of a social construct than it is an issue with, okay. with themselves. You
know? So what you're getting at, I think, is the fact that autistic people who are on the spectrum are perfectly fine with like themselves.
Absolutely.
And they're very happy to be who they are, or maybe they're not, but I mean they can function and exist perfectly well. And where it can become an issue is when typical people will look at them and say, oh, you can't do this, or oh, you can't interact like that. But for them, yeah. for the autistic person, they're like, I'm fine. I'm a little bit different, but I don't do this way, I do it that way. Is that what you're getting at?
That's what I'm getting at. Okay. A while ago, I was watching a documentary on autism, and
hello?
People talk about me as if I'm handicapped.
Sorry, hey, you cut off for 10 seconds there. Can you start again when you were
okay.
about the documentary you were watching?
Sorry. So I was saying, a while ago, I was watching a documentary on the topic of autism. And at some point over the course of the documentary, a girl says something along the lines of, people talk about me as if I'm handicapped, but when I'm alone in my room with my computer, I don't feel any sort of handicap or any sort of disability. And so that's crucial to understand, is that a disability, a handicap, is the product of your surrounding, and not of yourself and yourself alone.
Okay. Yeah, I see what you mean. Okay, so let's explain then what autism actually sure. is, and then we can continue sure. the conversation.
Sure. Let's do things in order. Right. Okay. So on a technical level, you would say that autism is a developmental disorder, meaning that, so to speak, my brain is wired differently. That's all it means. Okay. And so there isn't any sort of biological marker for autism, meaning that if you take my brain apart, you will not see anything odd or anything unusual with my brain just by looking at it. In the same way that, you cannot find any sort of biological marker with the brain of a person who's bisexual, for instance. You know, it's just not just not how it works. So the way we can diagnose someone with autism is only by looking at their behavior. So typically you interact with this person and you observe how they act, how they talk, how they speak, how they react. And based on this, you can find that they are indeed, quote unquote, wired differently. Mm. So that's a very simple way of answering your question. Does this satisfy your curiosity, Patrick?
Well, I mean, the most basic part of it, yes, sure. It's interesting to understand that there isn't like a physical, easily detectable mm-hmm. physical manifestation of it in the body. But then I want to know, okay, so how does it manifest and how close or far is it from the typical images that we were talking about in the beginning?
Right. Okay. So I should start off by saying that, once again, the autism spectrum is incredibly wide, okay? So this means that there is very likely, in fact, I know there is someone listening to this show right now who is on the autism spectrum. And maybe they will listen to this saying, well, no, that's not my experience at all. Or maybe someone's listening who's the parent of an autistic child and who will completely disagree with what I just said about disability being a social construct, you know? Mm. There are plenty of parents of autistic children who will get very pissed at what I explained earlier. and who will think that, no, my child is fundamentally handicapped. You know, this is something that you hear a lot. So the reason I mentioned this is that this is obviously my experience. This is my my point of view, my perspective on autism. And you are very likely to find someone who completely disagrees with me, which doesn't mean I'm wrong. But you know, I wanted to mention that. Okay, so what was your question?
Well, let's give examples of, you know, what autism means for someone.
Yeah, so the way I like to go about it is to say that. It's about empathy. Okay, so there are two different types of empathy. There is affective empathy and cognitive empathy. So once again, I'm having interviewer syndrome. Patrick, do you know the difference between cognitive empathy and affective empathy?
I'm going to say no, because I have done enough of a fool of myself in the last 20 minutes. Okay. So I'm going to let you. Go ahead.
Okay, so I would say that if right now you were to tell me that someone close to you has passed, I would feel immense sadness for you. And this is obviously affective empathy. I would, you know, your inner feelings would be contagious. I would feel the sadness that you feel, and I would relate to you. Okay, so this is. Affective empathy, it's about feelings, it's about emotions. Now, cognitive empathy is putting myself in your own shoes. So, for instance, I tell you that I don't like listening to your podcast about video games, and you say something in response. I am someone who cannot, for the life of me, explain what goes on in your head at that moment. And I cannot imagine myself in your position, imagine myself in your shoes, and describe what goes on in your head. Does that make sense?
So you mean, now you're talking specifically about your own experience?
I mean, and about autism in general, but the autism experience, yeah.
Okay, so... you're saying that you could say something mean about my show, or not mean, but, you know, like you don't see how it would affect...
I could say something inappropriate. Yeah, I could say something inappropriate, and I would not necessarily realize it I could say something that makes you uncomfortable, and I would not be aware that what you're feeling right now is discomfort.
So it comes back to feelings a little bit, but it's not emotional empathy, it's cognitive, like the state
right.
that the person in front of you is in, given the information that they have, or you know, the situation they're in. You can't relate to that, or you know, an autistic person might not be able to relate to that state.
I cannot decipher it. I can relate to your emotions if I know that you're obviously being very sad or very angry for a reason. I can relate to your emotions. I'm going to have a lot more trouble deciphering, putting myself in your own shoes. Yeah.
So is it fair to say that you understand the emotions that someone feels, but you don't understand the link between the situation they're in and why it creates that emotion? You're like, well,
that's absolutely right. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, and that is a characteristic of autistic people, or is it also, I mean, both types of empathy can be affected with autistic people, or is it only the cognitive empathy?
So affective empathy is either at a normal level or much, much stronger. It's very common for someone with autism to be very sensitive to, let's say, the emotions of the people around them. But so it can be either normal or higher than average, whereas cognitive empathy is always at a deficit when you're talking about autistic people. Yeah.
Okay. So there's an excess in, or, you know, a regular or excess level of emotional empathy, but always a lack of cognitive
deficit,
empathy.
Yeah.
A deficit of...
That's right. Again, yeah. In comparison, if I'm... So there's this sort of... I would call it a dream. I don't know. This idea of forming a country, because this is, after all, the Phileas Club. We're talking about geopolitics. forming a country with only autistic people. Obviously, it's nothing serious. It's just I would call it a recurring joke. And so if I was obviously all alone in a room filled with autistic people, my cognitive empathy would not be deficient. You know, it would mm-hmm. be the norm. So once again, it's a social construct. Yeah.
So, but you're obviously we keep saying that there's a spectrum and there are different levels of the. Oh, okay. So first, let me ask you: are those the only characteristics of autism and its variants? No, it's not. Okay. Because
no, it's not. It's,
because. The one thing that comes to mind as well is that sensitivity to stimuli, right? The sensory overload I was talking about, that I was under the impression was also part of autism in extreme cases. But is that just an excess of emotional empathy, or is it something different entirely?
Okay, so I started off by mentioning this difference between... I mean, the levels of empathy, I would say that it all starts from there. So, for instance, we'll touch on hypersensitivity in just a bit, but...
Oh, that's the word I was looking for. Thank you.
Yeah. So, for instance, one trait of autism is what's called specific interests. So it's this... So if you were to open a textbook about autism today, it would be filled with lots of stereotypes about autism, which once again is a very wide spectrum, but it's often summed up with a bunch of stereotypes. So typically people think that it only affects boys. It's something that we'll touch on later, I think. People seem to think that it's something that affects children, which is obviously not true. I'm here to prove it, and people will say, okay, so people with autism have immense social difficulties, I guess you would say social impairments, and they are awful at social interactions. And so once again, I'm here to demonstrate that the autism spectrum is very wide. And, you know, I have my own podcast. I interview people. I spend
would you say you're on the
huge part of my day here on Discord? Yeah.
Would you say you are on the lighter side of the autism spectrum, or is that the case?
I don't know if I'm willing to to segment the spectrum in such a manner, but I would say that my needs for assistance are fairly low. I'm an autonomous person, yeah.
Because I've, as I hinted at earlier, I think I've known you for a while, and I had no idea. I think when you describe things like cognitive empathy and maybe a lower deficiency of that, I can think back and think, okay, maybe there were a couple of interactions where I thought, oh, that's a weird way to react. But, okay. You know, so it kind of, I make it fit. But I could say that about half the people I interact with on the Discord as well. So it's not, yeah. You know. So you're definitely, okay. I would not have guessed that you were right. On the autistic spectrum.
Okay, so just to touch on this, and then we'll go back to your question about, other autistic traits. But the idea that you would never have guessed, look, I know people who are on the autism spectrum who are producing or hosting or who have a segment on national TV or national radio, whether that's in Belgium, in France, or in Switzerland. You know, it's important to understand that we are not a teeny tiny 1% who stays hidden in their room forever. It affects. I can guarantee that all the people who are listening to this show right now have people in their surrounding who are. I'm laughing at a comment I read on the Discord just now. So I would say that. There are people who are on the autism spectrum everywhere in the surroundings of all the people who are listening to this show right now. They are just not necessarily aware of it. And you mentioned that you were not aware of autism in my case. Well, it's something that's, I believe, very common. This idea that, oh, I've never noticed. This person is probably a very typical person, but no. It's very subtle, and it's not necessarily a very obvious difference, which is why it's sometimes described as, and you have to be careful with this, but it's sometimes described as the invisible difference.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, if you want to talk about famous people with autism, you can talk about, obviously, the wonderful Greta Thunberg is a very known example, but you also have for instance, Chelsea Manning. That's perhaps something that not everybody knows, but she's obviously she was incarcerated at some point, and when she was put in jail, she was diagnosed with what they call Asperger's syndrome. You also have, for instance, Satoshi Tajiri, which is the creator of Pokemon. You also have the rapper Eminem. You also have Courtney Love, which is the lead of the rock band Hole, and the widow of Kurt Cobain. And it's not official, but I would bet $1 billion that Edward Snowden is on the spectrum as well. So that this is just to show you that we are everywhere, and it's not just a teeny tiny 1% hidden somewhere. Mm. Yeah.
So, okay, I don't want to forget this, so I'm going to get back to it. And then I want to ask you again about the different traits that are characteristics of autism. But you were talking about the island. and the country where all the autistic people could be typical in their own country. But I do,
sure, yeah.
But I do wonder, since there are differences in those levels of cognitive and emotional empathy,
yeah.
Wouldn't there? I mean, it's not like neurotypical people all have the exact same level of cognitive and emotional empathy,
right?
But it seems like it's a characteristic of people who are on the autistic spectrum that they have varying levels. So, wouldn't people in the glorious country of autism also, you know, there would be some of them who could relate, some who couldn't. You know, when you say, we would all feel typical because we would all be on a similar level. Is this really the case, since there are such variances?
Okay, so this is where this this idea of an autistic island or autistic country has obviously its limit. Just than anything else. But I will say that personally, and again, this is my experience, this is my perspective, and your mileage may vary. But personally, it has become a criteria for me. Before I get close to someone, I strongly prefer if they are on the autistic spectrum as well.
Because you understand each other better, or
yeah, we can connect. We function on the same frequency. Mm. Whereas it's not the case with, I would say, most neurotypical people. Yeah,
it's funny. Obviously it has nothing to do with autism, but when you say that, I'm somehow reminded of my first trip to BlizzCon, where repeat, it has nothing to do with autism, but it was the first time I was immersed in a group of people that understood what, you know, a night elf was. You know, like, you could talk about anything of those, and there was this cognitive...
You had this sense of belonging, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, like, but it's more than just belonging. It's like, it was... my people, because we understood each other. It's not just we knew the same things. We could just communicate on a different level, almost. So again, nothing to do with autism, but I kind of understand, because I have this experience. It maybe helps me a little bit understand what you mean when you say that. Okay, so
right. So while I do have this sense of, you know, I feel this. This sense of tribalism, almost like this. Mm. We talk about sisterhood or brotherhood, or, you know, this camaraderie of autism, almost. I really cherish this, but it's not the case for everyone. I know people who know they are autistic, and whom I know to be autistic, and who will just say, like, oh, I don't really care. Like, this is not something important for me. So once again, yeah, the spectrum is very large and your mileage may vary. Yeah.
All right. So let's delve into the other traits of autism. And then I want to talk about the way it affects someone's life in very concrete terms. But first, other terms other than the empathy we were talking about.
We keep digressing is what I mean to say. So I was talking about this notion of specific interests. So what is this? A stereotype about autism is, okay, this idea of this young boy who is obsessed with, for instance,
building toy planes,
manhole covers, or World War II tank models, or dinosaurs, or things like that, and they will know everything there is to know on this topic, and they will be completely obsessed with it, and it's the only thing they care about. Okay, so this is obviously the very stereotypical portrayal of autism. If you were to ask me, I don't have such a thing, but I do have. So I like to describe specific interests as this sort of mental special place, meaning that in situations where I feel distress or anxiety, it's a very peaceful place I can go to and focus on this thing. And it's something I know by heart. It's something I, it's something that's very appeasing to me. Okay. So this is my own definition of a specific interest. And I think it's more interesting to be, a bit more abstract than the, than this stereotypical I'm obsessed with dinosaur things, because it's, it, you know, I personally don't recognize myself. I don't recognize myself in it. So,
but maybe I can see how dialing that up to 11 could mean that, you know, it's the specific interest is something comfortable for someone. With.
But what I disagree with is that it's only ever at 11. You know, in my case, it's not.
Right.
So in my case, for instance, hey. Patrick, can you guess what my specific interest might be?
I know your interests, but I would not venture a guess about your specific interest. But if you tell me, I'll say if I could have guessed or not.
So one video game I've played dozens and dozens and dozens of times ever since I was 8 is Metal Gear Solid 2. And something I know by heart. Yeah, and it's something I cherish very much, and yeah, it's like
it's not video games, it's
very appeasing. Yeah,
it's not video games in general. It's not a genre. It's like this specific game that you've played through a number of times. Okay.
Yeah, and you know, I've since found maybe other interests. Like, as you know, I've written an article about the lack of. The lack of women in the sector of tech here in Belgium. And this is something, for instance, that I am absolutely,
passionate.
It's something
about?
I'm very passionate. I'm very passionate for this topic. Yeah. And it's something that's, I can feel when I am completely like focused and completely taken with a topic. And those two topics are very good examples for my specific case. Yeah,
that's. I think this is a good point. I wanted to talk about this a little bit later, but I think it's a good point at which to say this. I listened to an explanation you made about autism before we recorded the show, and towards the end of it, you said something that hit home very much with me, listening to you, and you were saying, you know, oh, there might be some difficulties in understanding, you know, the empathy issues and specific interests and things like that, and I was like, oh, but I'm a little bit antisocial, and I have like places of comfort, and I get. And by the end of it, you were like, "All right, settle down, people. Just because you have, you know, some measure of something that feels familiar with what I described, it doesn't mean you're autistic or that you know someone autistic. Like, it's still something that has to be diagnosed by." A professional. Like, you can't just, first of all, you're probably not autistic yourself. It's possible, but unlikely. And so I'm sure that some people listening to the show now were like, oh, but I have this place where I'm really comfortable. And like, but just this characteristic doesn't mean that you're autistic, right?
Not necessarily, no. And so the what you were mentioning just now, it's a segment in French of my podcast where I try to explain what autism is in about 15 minutes. And yes, I have had, despite this warning, I have had plenty of interactions, whether that's, you know, emails or Twitter or Slack or so on, with people who just tell me, hey, actually, I really think that there's something, you know, I think I might be on the autism spectrum. And so, I mean, this warning at the end saying, well, you know, be careful, just because you can relate with this and this doesn't mean that you're on the spectrum. It also doesn't mean you're not. So if you're listening to this and you're asking, you know, you're wondering things about yourself, I would suggest, you know, reading and listening to podcasts and watching videos on the matter and, you know, exploring this topic. Because yeah. just because you have to be careful doesn't mean you should ignore who you are.
I've realized in the past few years how antisocial I am. It's weird for someone who spends most of their life interacting with people, but
I do therapy on you. Is this the part where I start to?
Yes, please. No, but I'm just mentioning that I genuinely dislike interacting with people. It's weird, but I love interacting with people on my own terms. But social interactions, mm-hmm. like parties, were torture when I was a kid. When I was, a teenager and a young adult. And it was really difficult because I wanted to go to parties to hook up, you know? I wanted to get some. And it was so difficult. Anyway, so it's not the life of Patrick. Okay. But
it's very interesting because, so we were mentioning earlier this difference between, the empathy and cognitive empathy and so on. This has, and this is the next big autistic trait I wanted to talk about, this has a direct impact on, the social norm, meaning mm-hmm. that, for instance, if you were to, tell me that I'm, tell me that you have to cancel this meeting we have. We have a meeting and you have to cancel it.
Okay.
You will, for instance, politely excuse yourself or explain and apologize. You will maybe have some facial expressions, maybe smile a little bit, maybe, do some things with your face to express that you're sorry and that we'll have to talk at a later time. Okay. So, no point, Patrick, were you sat in a room and told, okay, so Patrick, when you have to apologize, you have to do this with your face and you have to smile a little bit and you have to say that you're sorry and you have to behave in this and this manner. All those things are implicit. You were taught those things implicitly. This is something that is much, much harder for people with autism, all these things, which today, based on what you just said right now, I will not maybe use yourself as an example. I'll say a neurotypical person might find all this very, very intuitive.
Yeah, I'll put you at ease. I think this is me being in the case that you described earlier, you know, at the end of your explanation segment, where I'm like, oh my God, me too, when really, like, not at all. It's just that I'm a weird, you know, I'm a little bit weird on that matter. I don't think I'm, you know, interact. Yeah. So, but yeah, so these things.
I like to be careful. And, you know, if I'm walking down the street, I don't want to assume, okay, this person is certainly heterosexual, they are certainly Caucasian, they are certainly a man, and they are certainly neurotypical. So I like to say I don't know if Patrick is on the spectrum or not. You might be, you might not be.
I don't know either.
I don't want to say for sure that by default you are not. You know, I don't want to be like this.
But so you were saying, so you don't, these are things that you kind of learn through naturally through osmosis with interacting with other people, and you sort of mimic how other people do, and neurotypical people just acquire these behaviors naturally. But for people on the autism spectrum, it's one of the traits that you don't.
Yeah. So this is what will lead to what you mentioned earlier, this idea that oh, those people are oddballs. They don't behave in a normal manner. They don't look at me in the eyes when I'm talking. This is once again a very stereotypical trait, this idea that autistic people look at the ground when they talk to you, which is, you know, I can relate to that. It's true on some level, but it's not always true. I once again, I know people who are autistic and are on TV, and you know, when I look at them on TV, I see them smiling, I see them very polite, I see them looking into the other person's eyes. And so what you have to understand is that while all these things are not intuitive to autistic people, they can still acquire those behaviors and mimic those, you know, I would call them those typical behaviors by intellect, right? So
it's a more,
bear with me for a second.
It's a more like you see, you learn, maybe someone tells you this is how you have to do it, or this is how people do it.
Right.
And then you have to actively think about doing it. It doesn't maybe come as naturally, but yeah.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. And so this is why we talk about acting as a chameleon, right? Mm. And so you will have people who are autistic and once again are very polite, smile, look into your eyes when they talk to you, and you could not guess for the life of you that they are not that they are neuroatypical, that they are on the autism spectrum.
But so
this is why just for a second, this is why I mentioned that there is no biological marker of autism that you have to establish or diagnosis based on the person's behavior. But here's the thing. Autistic people are actively, for the most part, you know, they are often, quote unquote, faking their behavior and acting as if they are not autistic. Mm. And so this is what makes them perhaps very hard to spot. I don't know if you've seen the movie... what's the name of that movie with Harrison Ford, where he has to find the robots in the wild?
The robots?
Blade Runner, right?
Blade Runner, oh!
You've seen Blade Runner, right?
Yes.
At some point in the movie, he's like having a meeting with this person who's a robot, who's an android, and he looks at her in the eyes and they have this long conversation. And at some point, she does something very subtle with her eyes, and he knows that she is a robot, but she herself does not know it. And so that's another important thing to understand about autism, is that a lot of times people don't know that they are autistic. Mm-hmm. I only found out a couple of years ago.
Oh, really? Okay. So you found out after we got to know each other. That's interesting.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So I do want to get back to the looking at the person and looking at the floor example that you gave, because in that situation, what you're saying is the person who's looking at the floor, the person who's atypical, is looking at the floor not because they are like maybe ashamed, or they don't know what to do with their look, or they don't know what to do with themselves. It's just that's how they behave. Like, oh, I look at the floor, it's fine. Or I look, you know, at the sky or whatever. And
the idea that you have to not look at the floor is, once again, a social norm. It's an arbitrary rule that we've established as a society. But to me, for instance, I will often have a conversation and it can be about, like, I don't know, like a very deep and complex subject. And I have to think about, really focus on this topic. And when I'm focused on this very complex topic that we're talking about, I don't really think about looking at you in the eyes. I just try to focus on the topic at hand, and my eyes will go wherever they will go. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I also don't look at people in the eyes very often, but I will, just for the sake of it, I will mention the fact that looking at someone in the eye is a way of communicating, and maybe communicating intent, or giving some indication about your state of mind. And so there is a biological reason why, you know, you look into someone's eyes. So it's not, I would argue it's not just a social construct.
No, no.
We didn't just one day all decide, okay, let's all look at each other as in the eye and not at the floor, because why not, right? There's a reason for it.
It's both. It's both. It makes sense on some level, but it's also a norm, you know, something that is expected.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I really do want to get to the other traits and hypersensitivity, because this is certainly part of that typical stereotypical image we have. What about hypersensitivity? Is it, you know, real? Is it, does it only happen for young boys, or like how does it manifest?
Right. So it's definitely real. And once again, the spectrum is very wide and people's experience may vary. Personally, things, and once again, I think I will say this and everyone will say, well, I can relate with this. I'm like this too. You know, being near someone who does the dishes and hearing all the plates clinging and so on. Yeah, that's a nightmare for me.
Really?
But, you know, perhaps a weirder thing is holding a glass that was recently in the dishwasher and has a lot of, how do you call this? Like calcaire.
A
lot of limestone, a lot of, I don't know.
The white, you know, traces.
Remnants.
Yeah.
On it, and touching it is unbearable for me. It's insufferable.
Okay.
And it's things like that. And I will also say, and that's maybe a weird thing, is that I've had for a couple of years now a wonderful noise-canceling headphones. And nowadays, I don't know if it's related to the fact that I know I'm autistic. I don't know if it's related to the fact that I wear this pair of headphones most of the time. But I feel like I'm more sensible than I used to be. I don't know. I feel like I wasn't complaining about the plates clinging and the sounds of someone doing the dishes when I was a kid. But nowadays, it's insufferable. So I don't know what's up with that. But yeah. So, once again, I would say this is a very mild instance of hypersensitivity. I know people who are very sensible to colors. I know people who cannot imagine walking next to someone who's smoking on the street, and they have to, switch sides.
Mm.
So, once again, your mileage may vary.
So it is real. It's not just for young boys, and it's just something that assaults your senses more than it would a typical person, and that makes you like it's painful, and I guess it's just painful.
Yeah, I mean, just imagine what it's like when someone is scratching the blackboard. You know,
right. You
everyone knows what that's like. Well, you know, that's sort of like that. And I will also say that hypersensitivity is not just for autistic people. You can be hypersensitive,
if
you're not autistic. Hypersensitive.
So it's not like it's just that hypersensitivity is more often found in as a trait in autistic people, but obviously it's not exclusive. It's just that you find it more often.
That's right.
So it's one of the markers, one of the indicators that someone might be autistic, because a larger percentage of the autistic population is hypersensitive than of the non-autistic population. Right?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So, do you have another trait you want to explore?
Just tell me in quick fire all the traits of autism. Because I genuinely don't know. Like these ones we mentioned, I kind of knew, but I don't know if there are others. You know, are there 50? Are there 5? Are there a million? Like, is it impossible to know? Just give us an idea of what different traits, autistic people might show.
Let me think. So
I'm guessing these are the big ones, but...
Those are clearly the big ones. One thing I might... Okay, so this is more of a stretch, but not so much. I mentioned that social norm has less of an effect on people who are on the autism spectrum. such as, for instance, the idea that you have to look into people's eyes, or that you have to smile, or that you have to be polite in a certain way, and so on.
But isn't that
a much more simple example? Yeah, go on.
Isn't that a product of the deficit in cognitive empathy, or is it a different thing?
Very likely, yeah. Yeah, okay. That's very likely.
Okay.
And I will say that these are the types of question when, if you interview like a psychologist or a therapist that's an expert in autism, a lot of times these questions they will answer, oh, we don't know. We don't know why it's like this. We don't know why they have specific interests, and you know, and so everything is sort of focused on what we can observe and what we can see in their behavior. But explaining things, it's you know, people tend to be more careful with that. So the idea that the two are related, I mean, to me it's very obvious, but it's not necessarily something you would read in a textbook on autism, I think. And so I mentioned that the social norms have less of an effect on people with autism. A very good example of that is that there are something like 2 or 3 times more people who are LGBTQI on the autism spectrum versus among neurotypicals. And that's very interesting. Mm. So would you want to guess why that is?
I would not want to guess why, because again, making a fool of myself is something I often do on this show. But
Well, Patrick, it's because, and once again, this is just me talking, but to me it's very obvious. It's because gender is a construct as well. You know, being a man, being a manly man, being a girl, being a girly girl, all those things are social constructs as well. And you are not born a manly man, and you are not born a girly girl. And so this is why, and you know, it's a bad way to phrase it, but this is why we say that the typical Aspie girl, Aspie meaning person with Asperger's, and again, we should talk about this word, but anyway, let's move on. The typical Aspie girl is a tomboy, is the phrase we often hear, meaning that they look like they look and behave and dress like boys. And so what I very often heard among my female autistic friends is things like, oh, when I was a teenager, I used to dress in the men's aisle, or sometimes I feel like sometimes I feel more feminine and sometimes I feel more masculine, or I don't, you know, someone who is very close to me will tell me that they don't like being called a woman, that they just want to be called a person, and that they don't identify with any sort of gender, right? And all those things, the idea that you and I identify as men is mostly because we were told to, because we were told that this is who we are. But this is something that works less, that does not affect people with autism in the same way, because of what we mentioned before about the social norms and cognitive empathy. Yeah.
Okay. That's really interesting, and there would be a lot more to discuss there.
Obviously,
but
yeah.
let's not open the, you know, gender studies and
kind of forms.
Identity just now.
Oh, okay, so I mean, to me, the two are very strongly related. So I think this is not the last time we will mention this. But okay.
Asperger's, is it a form of mild autism, or what is it?
Okay, so if we go back to the roots of autism and when it started being studied, it was in the 1940s in like Austria by a scientist named Hans Asperger, who happened, like some of the scientists in Austria in the 1940s, happened to be a Nazi. So this is why this is one of the reasons why we don't really like to use his name anymore. Mm. And I think in general in medical sciences, they don't really like to use the name of people in parts because of this, because, you know, after a while you start to discover that some of them were for problematic.
Some of them were Nazis, so, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so that's one thing. The other thing is that for a while we were segmenting autism spectrum in different different parts. So we would say, oh, this is Asperger autism, or this is Kenner autism, or this is severe autism, and this is mild autism, or this is classic autism. And nowadays,
I can sense what you're going to say, so I will totally go back and edit out the part when I say, oh, so Asperger's is a form of mild autism.
No, because you're actually a big help by mentioning
by saying
the,
that. No, of course I wouldn't. I never edit anything.
Yeah, you're too lazy for that.
Exactly.
So nowadays, when you look at DSM-5, which is the latest and greatest textbook in the studies of I would call it psychological conditions. I don't know exactly how we define the DSM, but it's a very important textbook in the English speaking world. So nowadays they have removed all the mentions of Asperger's and Kenner autism and Asperger syndrome, and you know, this idea of syndrome, like, once again implies that there's something inherently wrong with the person, like this person has syndrome, whereas I would say that the disability, as we mentioned before, is largely a social construct. And so nowadays, we don't say Asperger's or anything of the sort. We say we measure the levels of required assistance, meaning that if someone has a lot of trouble simply just talking and simply interacting with someone else, and they need a lot of help, and they need help shaving, and they need help taking the showers, and something like that, well, we will say that. It's a level 3 of needs. I'm having a hard time explaining this, but it's a level 3 when you measure their needs, and then you would go down to level 2 if it's okay. Just they need a lot of help too, but less than level 3, and then you would go down to level 1 when it's a fairly autonomous person.
And those apply. To the spectrum of autism.
I'm sorry. Can you say that again?
Those apply to the spectrum of autism. So there's still some kind of classification on the severity of, your place on the spectrum.
You measure the people's needs and not necessarily, their own attributes, if that makes sense. Okay. And so another thing is that what you mentioned at the start of the show is that sometimes we tend to think of being either very smart or a genius or you know, at the opposite end of the spectrum, very being very deficient mentally. I need to make clear that the two are not related. You can be you can have autism and be a genius, or you can have autism and have a mental deficiency, and the two will interact. So I mentioned before that a lot of things that are very intuitive to neurotypicals are not intuitive to people with autism. The reason I managed to overcome these difficulties is because I happen to also have a relatively high IQ. And so because I'm somewhat smart, I can, just think, and this is a comparison that comes up a lot, I can think like a robot, I can think like a computer about social interactions and come up with a plan to just survive, overcome
the challenges.
Handling my own. Yeah, 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 absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I kind of digressed a little bit. What was your question again?
No, about Asperger's, but I think you answered it.
Yeah.
So let's finish up with, I think you were talking about how you managed to overcome the challenges. Can you give us a few examples that will illustrate to the people listening what it's like to, you know, be in your shoes for a day? Maybe a few examples of what people with autism, I'm not talking about challenges necessarily, but what life is for someone with autism and how it might differ from a neurotypical person's life.
Okay. So once again, the spectrum is very large. And in my very own case, I'm not necessarily the best example because I am sufficiently privileged to have a lot of control over my own life, meaning that I'm a freelance software developer and I work from home. So I don't have to go out and interact with people on the street and interact with people in an office and get yelled at by a boss or something, because I am my own boss. And so obviously I know people who are much less privileged than I am. And I've heard stories about people who had to work in a factory in the United Kingdom, for instance, and they are constantly being yelled at, and they are they need to fit within the norms, and they need to act a certain way to not being made fun of and not being bullied. So obviously I'm very privileged in that sense. I will say that when I was in school, you know, a criteria for being bullied is just differing from any sort of norm. And, you know, gender is also a factor in those things. But yeah, I will say that I used to get bullied a lot when I was in high school. Yeah.
But I'm looking for very specific examples, like you're going to the store, and there's, you know, the way you interact with the clerk or the way you look for an item. I really want to get people to give people listening, you know, a few concrete examples of how it differs from their everyday life, so that they get a little bit of an insight. Right. It doesn't have to be from your life.
Okay. I will say that I'm always awful when this question comes up. It's for some reason it's very difficult to me, because, you know, it's my life. So the idea that I have to look at what's weird in my life, where everything is normal to me, is obviously a difficult exercise. So let me think for a second. The examples I prefer are always the more subtle ones, like, I will do something that's considered not conventional. For instance, I remember being on a show with you a long time ago, and at the end of the show, I spontaneously mentioned that I had a podcast and that my Twitter handle would be in the show notes. And I remember that who was also on the show just found this hilarious. Like, oh, what is he doing? That's so weird to say that. He was not invited to say this. That's what an oddball. And this is a very simple example of, okay, so there was here a social norm. There was here an implicit rule that had to be followed, that I had to be invited to say that I have a podcast and that my Twitter handle will be in the show notes. And I did not wait to be invited to say this. And so people find this very odd and very funny, very either funny or annoying. It depends.
It's, I mean, so obviously you know the show. you know the show and you know my show, so you know that we always do that and that I always put the Twitter handle in the show notes. And I actually say at the end of the show that, you know, Twitter handles will be in the show notes. But
this is my first rodeo.
But it's interesting. Before we started recording now, you actually went ahead and mentioned in, so we're recording, for those who don't know, we now have a Discord instead of the Slack, and there's a public part of the Discord. If you want to join us, please feel free. It's mainly in French, but we also have English language sections in the Discord, and it's mostly for patrons, but everyone is welcome, especially in the public square part of the Discord. But you went ahead and you sent me a question on Twitter and said, hey, do you want to stream live? Because I've been doing it here and there on Discord. I might do the shows on Twitch at some point in the future, but do you want to stream live on Discord? And I felt like you wanted to stream it live, and I didn't have time to answer. And so you went on Discord and made the announcement that we would be streaming live on Discord. And so now I know that you are on the autism spectrum. If I hadn't known, I think I would have found this a little bit forward. Just like not inappropriate, but in the same way that you would say, oh, and the thing will be in the show notes, the Twitter account will be in the show notes, like you're kind of not imposing, you're deciding for me that it will be in the show notes, which is completely normal, because that's what I always do, and why would I not do it? But the fact that you're saying it for me is a little bit like socially, I understand why the other person, I can't remember who it was, I understand why the other person would say, oh, you are, you know, this isn't done, you know? And it's really interesting, because I completely see how this could be weird if you're just like, it. Why would I not put it in the show notes? Obviously it will be. You know? But the fact that you're saying it is like, oh, you're... So anyway, it's a great example. I love it because I can completely relate to it.
I'm glad, because I was afraid that this would be an awful example, that very anecdotal. But the fact that you see what I'm talking about, and that there was indeed a social norm that maybe I broke or something.
And so for you, you didn't... reassuring. Yeah. You didn't see that social norm at all. You were just like... Well, he puts it in the show notes.
Maybe I see it, but I'm like, does it really matter? Like, it's not, rules are meant to be broken, and I don't find this crucial. I am like, okay, this is a very arbitrary rule, so I guess not very important. I don't know.
I see. Are there? Other, can you think of other examples of something like that where you, again, it's not, it doesn't necessarily have to be you specifically, you know, you're interested in, you know, autism in general, so maybe you have examples from others, but another example where this kind of interaction or another one would have been perceived in different way by someone on the spectrum and someone who isn't on it?
Give me an hour to think about this. You're kind of putting me on the stop, on the spot. Sorry. Let's see.
Well, then I'm surprised that you don't have a bag full of examples, because as I mentioned, and as you mentioned, this is a topic that is, very close to your heart, and you've talked about it and discussed it and studied it a little bit.
Like I mentioned earlier, it's my life, and so to think that every day I will write down something like, oh, today I was unusual, or today I had this weird behavior, is just not how I do it. Let's see.
Okay, that's fine. I
can think of, you know, like things like just, I know someone who, as a teenager, like as a fairly old teenager, had, you know, suddenly became very angry because she could not sit in the car where she was used to. And so this is maybe something we have not really mentioned thus far, and a very important part of autism is we really like to have our own habits, I guess, our own things we're used to, and we like them to stay that way. So in this case, the person was used to sit in a very in a certain spot in the car, and she could not, and it made her incredibly angry. And I can really relate to this. Mm. Actually, I have another one. I used to go on a website called Slack a lot, and and talk with my friends there all the time. And this is something where I go there on a regular basis, and it's something I'm really used to. And all of a sudden, hey, guess what? Someone decided to move to Discord, and that made me very distressed. And so, actually, I think I showed you. I wrote some CSS code to skin Discord to make it look like Slack.
That's so, yeah. That's I think it was before. I think it was before I realized you were on the autism spectrum.
It's at that exact point where we had this conversation.
Yeah. And yeah, that I think that's when you mentioned it. But it was indeed a reaction that was maybe out of proportion with what I would expect the reaction to be regarding that change. I mean, obviously, you know, some people dislike change, but it really felt, even through written conversation, it felt like you were, as you mentioned, distressed by this change, which felt excessive. But yeah, so that's the kind of thing that would happen, I suppose. Are you happy now with the CSS that you wrote to reskin Discord?
Oh, I mean, it's problem solved, I would say. Yeah, but but the CSS is a big part of it. And you know, once again, you mentioned an excessive reaction. Once again, excessive compared to the social norm. And if we were,
I did say excessive compared to what I would expect. I mentioned compared to what I would expect. I have a way with words, sir. I have now learned my lesson.
But so I would say that if this were autism land or autism island, it would have gone down very differently, I think, between the ways of how the decision was made and you know, whether we were asked if we were okay with it and so on. Mm-hmm. So it has a lot to do with, just what the implicit rules are.
Okay. I mean, in this case, obviously, I'm not asking anyone, because if I would ask people, I would never get anything done. It's a community of a few hundred people. So,
yeah, but I absolutely understand why you did it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I think this is a pretty interesting dive into autism and what it is and what it isn't. Is there anything else you want to add before we close off the show? And yes, your link to your Twitter account will be in the show notes.
Sure, yeah. I just realized I forgot to mention something, which is that we talked a lot about how this quote-unquote deficiency in cognitive empathy can affect our behavior, but the surplus or the relative importance of our affective empathy also has effects. And so, once again, I cannot say this for sure, and it's not written down in textbooks, but one thing you see, in the same way that you see a lot of people who vary in terms of genders and in terms of sexual orientation, something you see a lot when you look at people with autism is we tend to love our pets and to love animals. And so we have a lot of people who are, for instance, anti-speciesist, or vegetarian and so on. And for instance, if you take a look at Greta Thunberg, it's both a mixture of a lack of cognitive empathy and a lack of being affected by the social norms, which drives her to question, hey, wait a minute, why are we doing this to the planets? And the answer is, well, because we all do, because it's the norm, because it's something we're used to and we're not questioning it. But to her, it's like not intuitive at all. And she obviously finds it nonsensical as it is. And the other side of this is this cognitive empathy, which affects human, but also animals, but also nature, but also, you know, our planet as a whole, which, you know, drives her to find this absolutely horrendous. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. I just wanted to mention that autistic people often are passionate and very, you know, we love our pets, is what I'm trying to say.
No, but I think there's, you're right, something that we didn't really touch on, which I can see how this would be an asset. If you aren't as constrained by the arbitrary nature of social norms of the way things are, then you're more able to question their validity, right?
And absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting aspect as well. All right. Well, thank you very much, Guillaume, for being on the show and sharing your time and your expertise and your experience with us.
Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure. I find it very important to share the message on these matters. So yeah, thanks for having me.
I hope people have had an interesting time on the show. You mentioned you're a podcaster as well. It's mostly in French that you podcast, but maybe some people
mostly in French. Every once in a while, I publish an episode in English, but it's fairly rare. And so, if you're French speaking, it's called 70 Minutes Avec. It's a Belgian podcast where we talk about social issues at large, whether that's about journalism, technology, politics. Autism. I did like 3 episodes on autism. I wonder why. I'm not sure why. And so it's once every 2 weeks, and then the next episode is tomorrow, and it's about cancel culture.
Oh, very interesting. I did an editorial about cancel culture, after which you actually sent me a link to, oh my God, I forgot her name. Ugh. That video.
I don't even remember what you were talking about. So
maybe it wasn't
was it
you.
Really me?
Maybe it wasn't you, but there was a fantastic hour and a half exposé on cancel culture.
Oh, okay. So I think it might be Johan, and I think the video is Contrapoints.
Yes, Contrapoints.
Contrapoints. Yes, yes. It's a wonderful video. Yeah.
She was. It's an amazing video about the psychological processes and how it works, and like and how cancel culture is interesting and important but also goes too far sometimes. It's fascinating. Anyway, so I'll be looking forward to your episode on the topic as well. I think I might also include the link to that episode of ContraPoints in the show notes. Now that I've mentioned it, I think
it's
people
very good.
Will be interested.
It's very good, yeah.
Okay. And your Twitter account.
So obviously, my Twitter account will be in the show notes.
But give us the name still for...
It's GUIHACHEZ.
Oh, so you can't pronounce it because people in English, it doesn't work.
Obviously, no, it doesn't work in English. Yeah.
I'm NotPatrick on Twitter and everywhere. I am also at NotPatrick.com, brand new website, which is, I'm very proud of it. We worked on it very hard with Kevin. And it is a central point for everything I do, including different ways of subscribing to my different shows, and if you expand the little part about the Phidias Club, a link to the Patreon, where you can support the show financially. If you enjoy what we do, if you get something out of the show, if you think there is some manner of importance to the topics we discuss, then please consider becoming a patron, supporting the show, and maybe at a level that gives you access to the full Discord. You can join the Discord no matter what and discuss the latest episode. By the way, the link to that is also on notpatrick.com. But if you want to support support it at the level that gives you access to the entire Discord, then you will find a community of wonderful people of varying neurodiversity and other varying things to talk with. So I hope you consider it. Once again, patreon.com/thePhileas Club. The link will be in the show notes, just next to Guillaume's Twitter account, and also at notpatrick.com. Thank you very much for listening. We will be back in a few weeks with a regular episode where we talk about news from the world. Talk to you then. Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.